Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Coming up on this week's programme, we're going to be looking at the future. We're going to be speaking to Mark Dixon. He's a futurist. He's written 18 books and predicted things that have come to pass in the past. He's looked at AI and how it is encroaching on pretty much every sector in the world and our own personal lives. And we're going to ask, how do we keep humans in the loop? And what do we lose if we don't do that? If you would like to get in touch with the program, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter. We're at Newstalk Science. Now, if you would like AI to work for you rather than you work for AI, you can learn how to use these tools. And I think it's kind of important for Irish people to remain competitive by learning the tools that other people are using. And so I started a workshop called Get Started with AI. And you can learn how to use ChatGPT and other simple AI tools that don't require any coding to get stuff done and master them before they master us. If you'd like to get more information and tickets, we have some shows left or some workshops left in Dublin. Dunleary is sold out, but we have some for Bulls Bridge on the 30th of September. You can find information and details at getstartedai.com. Now, it's time to look back at some of the week's science. And joining me is Dr. Susan Kelleher from the DCU's School of Chemical Sciences and from the School of Natural Sciences in the University of Galway. It's Dr. Jessamine Fairfield. You're both very welcome. Our first story, Susan, has to do with pregnant brains.
That's right. I am amazed that this study hasn't been done before. Like, how have we not thought to monitor the brains of pregnant women? Because we know that a lot happens, right? I'm looking at you, Jess. Like, we've been there, right?
Can confirm,
you know, we've got two for three here that are confirming this. So this is basically, this study involved taking the scans of a woman's brain using MRI scanning before, during and after pregnancy. So the team that's now written this up is largely based in the University of California in Santa Barbara. Another element I like of this story is that they recruited a colleague who was planning to conceive by IVF, and they scanned her brain before conception and then every few weeks during the pregnancy until about 2 years after childbirth, and monitored all the changes in the brain. So, like, as if you weren't busy enough to be signing up for this, as if for the sake of science, is amazing.
And the like, results. Did they have like an fMRI in the bedroom, or like?
I don't know. Maybe she just slept. I'm sure they have them in every room in the University of California. They're so well funded. Take note, Irish government, fund us really, really, really well, please. So the results show that the brain changed week by week, with some changes being short-lived and then some lasting years. Previous work has been done with MRI scanning during pregnancy, but only ever snapshots, you know, intermittently, not really detailed as this and as consistent. So the biggest changes were in the reduction of gray matter volume and thickness, and they say particularly in regions involved with social cognition. And then
does that mean women get stupider when they're pregnant?
It's hard. I'm not going to say that. They don't say this, so I'm not going to say this.
But I presume it doesn't. I presume it's just changed. I presume it doesn't necessarily.
I don't want to say that either. Even I don't if it's want true. To say.
You know, no, that's not. Look, either there's evidence for it or there isn't. But
don't, yeah. No, they I don't draw isn't. That conclusion. Yeah, yeah, no, you know, this conclusion. I suppose they have a couple of other things that they say about white matter changing and peaking at the end of the second trimester and dropping back down, and then the kind of brain cavities, they're expanding, and that seems to be linked to rising hormone levels. They also monitored this lady's hormone levels throughout and did bloods. But they are very careful, as you said, not to extrapolate any cause and effect on this, because it's only one person. And that person said they didn't feel anything different during their pregnancy. They were fine, you know, so they certainly didn't think they were getting stupider. But I guess the main thing is it's never been done. And the amount of links between neurological disorders and pregnancy in general, around good and bad being pregnant often can reduce MS symptoms. We know about postnatal depression as a major problem, and there's even links between preeclampsia and dementia. So the fact that we're only starting to look at this is quite incredible.
Yeah.
And I, for one, take my hat off to the lady who signed up for this, because, you know, the amount of work to do this and to think about it, and she's on the paper, which is great. She gets her recognition for her contribution to the research. But I just think it's incredible. It's been this long to get to this point.
Indeed.
How much there is to learn is it's the start of it all.
Well, when we think of how much women's bodies change, you know, during pregnancy and the mad stuff, like we did a feature on it a few years ago. It's crazy all the things that happen to allow for birth, right, during the course of first, second, third trimester. Why would we think anything different for the brain? I guess for me, I hadn't really considered it, because when we think of the brain, we sort of think of the brain as being a very static thing. Like the brain is our brains. But actually, really interesting to see that actually physical matter changed, as well as presumably lots of wiring and the networking as well. Our second story, Jessamine, has to do with the standard model. So it's been a while since we've spoken about this. Would you mind reminding people what the standard model is?
Yeah, so the standard model, at this point, it's almost 50 years old, and it's a model in particle physics that describes all known subatomic particles. It covers a lot of the basic fundamental forces of nature, but it doesn't include things like gravity, which is kind of a big one. It doesn't include some of the cosmological phenomenon that we might see, like dark matter or dark energy. But one of the core things in the standard model is that for forces to be carried between particles, they have to be carried by what's called a gauge boson. And so there's headline news coming out of CERN. I know, of course, we're all tuning into the CERN press updates every week, that the CMS experiment, the compact muon solenoid, they've made the most precise measurement ever of the W boson, which is one of these gauge bosons. And excitingly, thrillingly, that measurement is in line with the standard model.
Wow.
I know, this is the kind of stuff.
But it is good, though. As boring as it sounds, that we measured something and it is as we thought it was, as is in the standard model. Actually, this is interesting.
Well, what's cool about it is that only 2 years ago, there was a really weird result that came out of another experiment, the CDF experiment at Fermilab in the U.S., that was also looking at the mass of the W boson. They were reanalyzing old data from the Tevatron, which shut down in 2011. And they predicted a mass for the W boson that was way out there compared to all the other measurements. Like, and it kind of raised the question of new physics. It was like, ooh, like, is this outside the standard model? Is there something that's not being included here? And that was kind of an open question at that point. And especially at that point, that new measurement in 2022 was the most precise one that had been done. All the previous ones, which were closer to the value that was expected, had huge error bars. And it was kind of like, well, this might be overlapping with what's predicted by the standard model, but maybe it just doesn't. And this new measurement from CMS absolutely does. It's the most precise one that's been done, and it does overlap with what we expect from the standard model. The way that they did this is, of course, at CERN, they have this incredible proton-proton collider. And basically, these researchers looked at collisions where a W boson would have been created, and then it would have decayed into either a muon or an electron plus a neutrino. You can't detect neutrinos using the stuff that's in the Large Hadron Collider at CERN, but you can detect muons in the compact muon solenoid. They looked at 100 million W boson decays, which is just so many. I feel like I just have to emphasize that. I've never done an experiment that had 100 million points in it.
Yeah, it's a lot.
And that's part of why this is such a precise measurement, right? That they really took a lot of data.
They really do. The amount of data they generate at this thing is incredible. So the two protons are like, they go round and round this circuit underneath the ground, and they get speed up. And then they are fired at each other. And even though these are like subatomic particles, they don't miss, because then the experiment wouldn't work very well. And they smash into each other, and the debris is what's collected. And that debris of these particles, that's different amounts of energy in various different frequencies or whatever, various types of energy that hits this.
So they have all sorts of detectors around the area where the collisions happen. And that's why, you know, they can run a few months of, you know, very, very high energy, very like expensive to run collisions. And then they can analyze it all sorts of different ways. And
One way to think about it might be that, you know, when they you know, smash into each other, you know, they break into other bits, and then that decay is as the bits sort of like sort of drip down the walls of the collider. That's kind of how I think about it.
Well, and like, even though these aren't the particles that we see on our day-to-day basis, they underlie everything around us. So it's really amazing to get these results.
Yeah, very cool. And it's great to hear about the poor old Standard Model, you know, standing up for itself for once, because it has been attacked quite a lot over the last while. A lot of the time by me, I think, you know, the whole dark energy thing, I keep saying it. I'm telling you now, dark energy and dark matter are going to prove to be just a poor decimal point placing. That's what's going to happen. People are going to go, oh, actually, no, actually, we don't need dark. We need to do this mass and now, and then it's all going to disappear. And people's entire careers in dark energy and dark matter are just going to like poof. That's my prediction.
I don't agree, but let's see what the data bear out.
Right. Our third story has to do with cancer, Sarah, Susan.
Yeah, this is a good news story in the world of cancer treatment, and it concerns extending the life of life expectancy of patients with advanced melanoma. So advanced melanoma is classified as a melanoma that has either not been receptive to treatment from surgery or has metastasized, meaning that it's spread to a secondary place in the body. Now, 15 years ago, only one in 20 patients with advanced melanoma survived for 5 years, with many of them dying within like 6 or 9 months post-condition. But with the, and sorry, when then with the current level of diagnosis at an all-time high, this treatment, you know, we need to come up with a new way of actually treating it and to improve that survival rate. So work published this week in the New England Journal of Medicine reports on a trial therapy using two immunotherapy drugs, which showed that more than half of the people with advanced melanoma that were trialed on this trial now survive for at least 10 years. Which, considering it was 1 in 20 for 5 years, we've gone to 50% surviving for 10 years or more. So this is a huge jump. And the drugs, I won't try to pronounce them because they're these immunotherapy drugs and they have very complicated names. But basically, they're immune checkpoint inhibitors, which are drugs that basically stop the body's immune cells from being overactive, which can happen in cancer, that where they attack healthy tissues as well. So these drugs go in and they stop the immune system from basically attacking healthy cells, which means it can put all its energy towards then actually attacking the cancer cells, which are the ones that need all the focus. So that means then that the immune response against the cancer is so much greater, which means then you've got a much better response from a treatment. So the trial involved 945 patients with stage 3 or 4 melanoma, and it was the longest follow-up to date of patients that were receiving these drugs. And then even people who had to stop the treatment early because of maybe side effects, they also saw effects because the drugs are already in there, sort of programming the body to do it's the proper job instead of the job, you know, the wrong job. So it's incredible. The main problem that they said the authors have is what happened to the other 50%? You know, why haven't they responded to this? So that's kind of the big thing is, those who aren't responding to these immunotherapies, what's going on there? And that's kind of more stuff that needs to be to study there. But it's really a great story.
I was at an event run by Breakthrough Cancer Research recently, and they're an amazing organization. They fund sort of, you know, a basic research that you know, often doesn't get funded elsewhere. And they were, you know, they had a bunch of immunocell therapy heavy hitters, including a Nobel Prize winner come over. He was over for an event anyway, and he came and spoke, and it was really like the potential and promise of these therapies are amazing. The problem is access and cost, and you know, really I think our government does need to think about, you know, yes, these are expensive, but how do we reduce that cost? How do we get them to patients? Because a lot of these patients, you know, they hugely benefit the economy and society if we have a really high functioning healthcare system. And I think we just need to maybe figure out how to get quicker and better access to these therapies. So it's about valuing research and about saying yes to new and innovative drugs. Our final story, Jess, has to do with breathing through your anus.
That's right. It's my favorite time of year when the Ig Nobel Prizes are awarded. This is a set of awards for not Nobel Prize winning research, but research that makes you laugh and then think. And these researchers from Tokyo Medical and Dental University and the University of Cincinnati did a study where they were looking to see if mammals could breathe through their anuses. Now, there's a lot of aquatic animals that can, like loaches. They can absorb oxygen through their intestines. And this research was done kind of early on in the COVID pandemic. And, you know, as we all know, severe COVID put a lot of people into respiratory failure. There was not enough ventilators and artificial lungs available for people. And like, if you've ever seen someone on a ventilator, like the intubation is very invasive. It's a pretty horrible process. So
I have no idea where this is going, but I'm very excited.
Yes. They're like, what if instead of having to ventilate all these people, what if some of them, could they absorb oxygen through their intestines instead? What if the oxygen were anally delivered? So this is this idea that's borne out in other parts of the great diversity of species of the gut as a breathing organ. So these researchers did this study. Now, I should note that it was not on humans. It was on mice and pigs. And they explored in mice and pigs that were in respiratory failure, the rectal delivery of high oxygen liquid. They call it enteral ventilation because I think that's just a more polite phrase. But they found that actually using this treatment, it enabled blood oxygenation, which is what you're looking to do if you have someone on artificial breathing. It improved survival. There seemed to be no major complications. So a lot of it was very positive. And they were like, you know, this should be an approach that we're looking at when people are in respiratory distress. Now, there's one major caveat, which I didn't see in a lot of the coverage of this. But if you go to the original paper, they talk about how the intestinal walls of mammals are quite different than the intestinal walls of a lot of marine creatures. So they had to thin them to get the oxygen to absorb. And they talk about like abrading the intestinal walls to make the membranes thinner so that the oxygen would come in from the liquid. Now, I'm no doctor, but doesn't sound great. Like, I mean, you'd rather be alive and have intestinal issues than die from respiratory failure. I acknowledge that. But that is something that I would love to see addressed.
Definitely something to think about. Looking at different mixes of gases, I mean, a proof of concept is interesting. Looking at different mixes of gases or even highly oxygenated liquids, perhaps there is a way of thinking about it sort of laterally. I'm always amazed that, you know, that we haven't yet developed a way of breathing underwater. And I kind of feel like there must be a way of extracting oxygen from water somehow.
Has an Ig Nobel Prize ever turned into a Nobel Prize? Because if not, this might be it.
Not yet. Yeah, maybe.
We can only hope. We should all write the Nobel Committee.
Dr. Jessamine Fairfield from the University of Galway and from the School of Chemical Sciences, Dr. Susan Keller. Thank you both very much. Now, while it is often overhyped, AI is definitely set to create a lot of benefits for humankind. And there are some that we haven't even conceived of yet. But at the rate at which things are developing, what sort of future will it lead us to? Well, Dr. Patrick Dixon, MBE, is a futurist keynote speaker and author of How AI Will Change Your Life, A Futurist Guide to a Super Smart World. He joins me now. Welcome to the program, Patrick. As there's lots of futurists out there, but you have been doing this for quite some time, which I think separates you from a lot of those people. And a number of the predictions that you have made by observing what's going on today and forecasting the future have come to pass. Can you tell me a little bit about those, just to give us a bit of a grounding of how you come to your forecasting?
Thanks. I'm a physician in my first training, and so science is very important to me. Data is absolutely vital. And yes, of course, futurists can make headlines by coming out with all kinds of crazy statements. Oh, we'll all have chips inside our head linked to AI in 24 months. But I'm a practical kind of guy, and my predictions are based on research, and I've written 18 books. This is my 18th book. It's called How AI Will Change Your Life. And how I addressed this was by looking at every single sector that I work with. I wrote a chapter on 24 different parts of our society, from marketing to, you know, working at home, to government, to cybersecurity, to banking, whatever it is, to address practically what this actually means. Because you're right, there's so much hype, there's so much nonsense being put out about AI. Let me just give you an example of a reality check, okay? Now, 85% of the world lives in the poorest parts of the world. Only half of those live in cities. Please don't tell me that some rural farmer who's tilling soil by hand in the northern part of Uganda is going to have her life turned upside down by AI in the next 12 months. No, I mean, really. And, you know, and some of the nonsense we've seen is really quite extraordinary about dire predictions for loss of jobs. You know what? There's nothing new in a way about AI. And I've been writing about AI for 25 years now. We've had the digital revolution for over two decades. You know, smartphones, the internet, all the kind of things you and I take for granted. But if you look at employment rates in Ireland, if you look at the UK, if you look at Europe, if you look at the United States, you'll find that in almost every country, the level of unemployment has gone down over the last 20 years, even though there were many so-called futurists 20 years ago who said, oh, we know we'll all be out of work in no time at all because of, you know, digital savings makes us more efficient, less jobs. What's actually happened is that for every job we've lost because of digital, I estimate that another two have been created. And you might wonder how that is. Well, I mean, if we take health, for instance, you know, a lot of people are worried about health. I'm a physician, so this is really, really important to me. I can tell you, I think that AI will probably save around 10 million lives a year by the year 2050. And we'll do it through a whole host of things. Matching data. You know, for instance, if you got a child with a suspected meningitis or something like that, AI is already better than any radiologist in Dublin at deciding whether your child has something wrong with their brain scan or not. AI is brilliant at doing those kind of things. AI is super smart when it comes to things like matching your genetic code to the genetic code of, let's say, 100 million other people and trying to work out whether you're more likely to get a heart attack by your 45th birthday. You know, fantastic at doing things like that. But please don't tell me that if you're sick and in hospital, an AI robot is going to come around and tend to your deepest needs. That's nonsense.
Yeah, I think, you know, all of this work towards an empathetic robot that, you know, obviously in Japan, there's a big cultural affinity with robotics. I'm still very much convinced that the things that we really want to consume day to day, whether it's healthcare or entertainment or you know, exactly, running with somebody as a partner, they we'll still want them to be humans for quite some time. Yeah,
absolutely. But, you know, if you go out for a restaurant meal, there's no way that you want a robot to come to your table. The whole.
Well, unless it's a robot restaurant, which was kind of gimmicky and cool. Right, no, generally not.
Yeah. But at the end of the day, as every restaurant owner knows, it's all about hospitality. The best restaurants are run by people who love entertaining. They love entertaining their family, their friends, their neighbors, anybody who wants to come in. They just love making food. They love giving people pleasure. That's the magic. That's that creates the atmosphere. It's not just smart cooking. It's to do with the whole experience. That's why people go and see Taylor Swift. You know, the more virtual we are, the more physicality becomes important. So you can give away all kinds of music, but you know what? Buskers make a fortune on the railway stations around Dublin and at bus stops. Why is that? Because actually, in this virtual world, it's so great to see someone belting out a song as best as they can. And they're really there. You know, it's a real person.
Give me an idea of how you go about doing research for trying to figure out what's going to happen in an industry. Take an industry like insurance, for example. Yeah. How do you go about doing that? And are there any statistics or any evidence or research at the moment that gives you a sense in which this particular industry is going, insurance or banking or anything like that?
Well, you mentioned insurance, so let's take a deep dive there. The insurance is based on one big thing. It's trying to accurately predict the risk of something bad happening. And it might be the chance of you having a heart attack, or it might be the chance of you crashing a car, whatever it is, right? And the better your understanding of the individual and of their lifestyle, and the better you're able to match that kind of individual to other individuals and their kind of risk profiles in the past, the better your underwriting will be. And the better your underwriting, the lower your premiums probably, because you're able to say to Joe Bloggs, look, actually, we think that the risk of you tossing your car too fast, going around a bend at high speed, is extremely low because we know everything about you. We know all kinds of things. And AI can do that. AI, because it's crunching more data, because it can take a more sophisticated view than a human underwriter can, that gives us all kinds of additional power when it comes to making those decisions about what kind of premium you're going to get.
Yeah, but in terms of actual work that's being done right now or sort of research, because I can see on paper how a lot of these technologies could be really powerful, but they really do depend on one thing, and that is the willingness of people to share their data. And I used to think that everything went in one direction when it came to, you know, social evolution, you know, and I look at what happened in America, like Donald Trump, for me, was a real wake up call that actually history does not always just go forward. It also takes steps backwards. And when I look at all the predictions that people are making when it comes to artificial intelligence, the real stopgap to me seems to be how willing people are to give up a significant amount of their personal freedoms and data to make these things better.
Yes, that's true to an extent. But you see, let's take the two examples we've talked about. In healthcare, of course, you're willing to give up your data. Your data happens when a physician like me says, and how long have you had a cough or a cold? And do you smoke? And you're giving up your data voluntarily. Insurance is exactly the same. If someone wants to get the lowest premium, then they were very happy to answer all the questions, because the questions help the insurance company to gain confidence that they're not going to be a high-risk driver. And the ultimate giving up of data, by the way, in insurance is to have live monitoring. So you've got insurers you know, that are pricing 18-year-olds out of the market, an 18-year-old can't afford to drive. So the 18-year-old says, okay, well, look, what if I have a black box in my car? Then you can watch me drive. And the insurance company can see how often the brakes being applied, what the velocity is at which they're taking curves. They can see whether they're driving at 3 o'clock in the morning. Mm. And it's revolutionized underwriting. So you have volunteering to give all kinds of data that you wouldn't have imagined anyone would even collect. But all of that gets collected by AI. It's a fantastic example of the use of AI now in insurance. It's analyzing the data from such black boxes. And that means that an 18-year-old who's cautious and careful will be rewarded. And they might have half the premiums of some, you know, a daredevil person who's always screaming around corners at 1,400 miles an hour at 4 in the morning. You know, that person will be uninsurable rapidly. So it's a very good example of a data-based, sophisticated use of AI that doesn't invade privacy. It's inviting the customer to go on a journey with the company that will actually benefit them.
When you, as you say, you go through all of these different sectors and sort of make predictions as to how AI will radically change them. Was there one piece of research or evidence that you saw that made you think, wow, this is probably, of all the industries, this industry is going to completely transform in front of our eyes?
Well, I've mentioned health, and that is a really big one. But the other one is anything and everything to do with cybersecurity. And I have to say that if you were to ask, you know, what's the biggest risk with all of this for your average person, I would say it's them being attacked. Is AI being used as a tool against them rather than for them? You know, if cybercrime were a nation, it would be the third largest economy in the world right now. We're seeing 560,000 new types of malware every 24 hours, Jonathan. That's now. Last year, we saw 500 million new ransomware attacks in a year, just in 1 year. We know that one in three companies in Ireland will go out of business if they're attacked by ransomware. One in three. That's why one in 10 of them pay out. And the average payout is around 500,000 euros, okay? One in 10 US citizens are having their identity stolen every single year. Look, I'm just saying this is now. We're in a world where AI is beginning to be used, but AI is being about to be hijacked on a massive scale by criminals and by rogue states. States like Russia working with criminal gangs and giving them permission to use all kinds of systems and processes and access to all kinds of technology for the express purpose of attacking entire nations' infrastructure, destroying companies, making it very difficult for nations to do what they want to do. And of course, it's individual.
That seems intuitive, but do you have any evidence of that? I mean, have you found research to suggest that?
Yes, unfortunately, I do. Absolutely packed full. The book, if you look at the chapter on cybersecurity, you'll see it's there, page after page after page. I have not, you'd be glad to hear, actually given the web links, but I've shown examples of where you can buy AI tools already for around 1,000 euros. That would knock a bank out for a week, 1,000 euros.
You're painting a picture of upcoming chaos. I mean, is it possible that the advances of AI might actually render some forms of technology moot, or some services sort of moot? Will we all be taking cash out of the bank and putting them under our mattresses where AI can't get it? I mean, yeah. Is there an industry where you feel like, I mean, I would have thought trading, once you introduce AI into trading,
yes.
You've got two AIs trading against each other.
Yes.
Surely yes. There's no point in having any technology then.
Jonathan, I think one of the messages of the book, you know, you're asking what's the data for the predictions of the future. What I've done is tried to describe what's actually happening now. It is already the case that AI or AI-linked systems are influencing the majority of trades on the stock markets of the world. Around 97%, Jonathan. Okay. Now, two or three years ago, they were what they were called algorithmic trades. They were sort of programmed to do with, you know, mathematical formulae. So, for instance, if a central bank announced an interest rate cut of 0.2%, automatically it was a pre-programmed decision that certain stocks should be sold. And
that caused a massive crash about
10 years
ago, right?
Yes. And now you've got AI linked to all that. So we've had some examples, and again, I've given them in the book, where fake news was circulated at a global news website, a really decent news website, was hacked. A false news story was put in there about there having been a bomb in the White House. And it was meltdown. It didn't last very long, but you don't need to cause meltdown for more than 15 seconds to make a huge amount of money if you are an AI-linked bot. Because what happens is the story goes out, you know that all the other bots are going to panic and sell. So you've sold out, you know, 20 seconds before the story goes out, and then you buy back 40 seconds later and you make millions of dollars. Central banks around the world are deeply concerned that the complexities of AI could create a similar banking crash or even worse to the one that hit us in 2009-10. Now, that was linked to all kinds of very complex financial products, which banks were trading with each other around the world. They were so complicated, Jonathan. I work with many of the largest banks in the world, and I was struggling to find anyone who could explain what these products actually did. So when the carnage happened, it took 2 years, Jonathan, for individual huge banks to work out what they'd lost, because it was that complicated.
It seems to me that the governments of the world are not yet up to speed to be able to put in regulatory controls on what sort of machines can interact with the stock markets. And even if they did put those controls in, I wonder, would they have the software to be able to prove that they did that? Maybe they might. But it sounds like if those checks and balances aren't in place already, you could see an enormous amount of manipulation of the stock market in a very short space of time that could make someone extraordinarily rich in a way that wasn't necessarily detectable.
Yes, you're quite right. And you are describing history, Jonathan. You know, I'm a futurist, so my job is to look over the horizon. But actually, the way I do that, to the point you made earlier, is by looking at recent history. And you're describing the technologies that are already in place. That horse has already bolted. AI is already welded into these trading platforms. I think the issue of government regulation is really important. And the first step is government licensing. So let's take Ireland. Ireland is a fantastic destination, as you know, for high-tech companies like Google. And these are, many of them, AI giants, and they're doing extraordinary things, which will have huge benefit for humankind, despite the downside. Okay, but what's really important is for governments in future to keep a record of who is doing what. So it's some kind of a licensing platform. And that means that they can see the spectrum of activities, let's say in Ireland, who is doing what kinds of work. You know, for instance, who is building, let's say, AI linked to cryptocurrencies that might destabilize the global economy. And then they will be in a better position to know how to regulate. At the moment, most governments don't really have a complete view about what's happening within their own territory. And the other thing that's important is these agreements need to go across nations, across the European Union for sure, but far beyond that, because otherwise there'd be a risk that, let's say, in Dublin, all kinds of new regulations come in, which make an awful lot of sense. And many other nations say, yes, yes, that sounds very sensible, but they don't implement the same things or they delay it. And you can be sure what happens next, which is that Google says, well, we'll carry on doing our you know, basic search and all the other products we do in Ireland, but our AI stuff has been offshored to, let's say, Mexico. So it has to be joined up.
Yeah, no, I think that's actually, in your book, you kind of give a sort of a step-by-step guide to how governments might protect themselves. And I think, you know, certainly understanding who's doing what, registering that and licensing them to be able to use AI in certain domains seems like a great idea. How quickly it will be put in place and whether or not it will be too late is something I suppose we will see down the line.
Well, again, Jonathan, the good news is it is happening. You know, the EU has just passed a huge raft of AI legislation, which will be implemented across Ireland. The United States is working in step with that. Many other nations too. But of course, you know, when you've got things like the Ukraine war going on, you've got the trade disputes with China. It's hard to get our world to agree on anything, as we've seen over climate change. So it's going to be patchy, but it's better than doing nothing.
Really interesting to see where that will land and whether or not we can plug leaks before they end up turning into floods. The book is filled with lots of insights from lots of different industries. It's called How AI Will Change Your Life, A Future Disguised to the Super Smart World. Patrick Dixon, author, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
I know people will find it funny. We got a few texts in from people saying that you run that feature and then you're teaching people about how to use AI. And there, you know, there's definitely good things about this technology, of course, like all technologies. And there are things we do need to be careful of. I think, you know, just letting stuff run is dangerous. And also it's quite wasteful. You know, some of the stuff I've seen online, people are like, we can just do this. And, you know, the benefit versus the actual cost of doing these things, I think, is always questionable. I think you do need to be conscious and mindful when you use these sort of technologies that can take up a huge amount of energy to produce results. You need to be thoughtful about what you're doing. And I think a lot of the time people are just generating images and so on just for the fun of it. And I think we should probably be just a little bit more thoughtful about how we use, like any resource on the earth, right? Although I am anticipating some people saying, you ran that feature and now you're going to teach people how to use ChatGPT. I think I'm okay with that. Right. We were talking last week about what happens to your data when we die. Really interesting conversation. Dom in Dublin says, Facebook did have a disclaimer about 10 years ago where you signed to say, when I die, my Facebook account is my domain and not that of Facebook's. I think there has been a bit of maturity, as we heard last week, because people started dying on Facebook and they needed to figure that out. But in the early days, it was really a lot less clear. And with some other companies, what they do and how you can get access or should you get access, it's an interesting question. And we're also talking about lab-grown meat. And we got a tweet from someone saying, I would happily switch over to lab-grown meats as soon as they become commercially available. As far as I know, some manufacturers that have already gotten the stamp of approval in the US and the UK, I think it's... the Amsterdam, not the UK. Don't think it's US, but maybe you might be right. The EU is far behind this one under pressure from the meat lobbyists, says the tweeters. Thanks very much for that. That's it on this week's episode. Next Tuesday, we're going to be playing a podcast in our feed on lucid dreaming. And that's where you wake up when you're asleep and you're aware that you're dreaming. And sometimes you can actually control that dream. If that's you and you can actually do that, we'd love to hear your story. You can email us, science@newstalk.com, or you can tweet us. We're @NewstalkScience. But that's it for this week's episode. Thanks to Simon Keane, Aidan McKelvey, Rory Galvin, and Hugo da Silva on sound. We'll be back with more, as I say, on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
Sunday morning at 10 on Newstalk.